It's like exploring a new country. And you cannot explore a country successfully if you care what you find. Because you might say to yourself, I don't think it's going to come out the way I thought it was, and so I'm going to quit exploring. No, it's the fun of finding out what it's like, rather than starting out with a preset idea, and if you find it isn't that way, you get disappointed. That's a ridiculous thing. So I don't fill up my mind with ideas of which way it's going to go. I just try to find out as much as I can.
What Feynman said would, of course, be echoed by most other scientists. You can't predict the course of discovery. You've got to have an open mind and be agnostic about the way in which our present ignorance will be removed. But theoretical physicists have more cause than most to remember this. They, after all, are constantly being surprised by the sheer novelty of the conceptual innovations that have made their discipline. Relativity, quantum theory, and so on. I talked to Richard Feynman last year, on his way through London back to California. Probably there's no such thing as a typical theoretical physicist. And certainly it's not Richard Feynman. For one thing, he's one of the handful of people who've grappled successfully in the past 25 years with the problems of fitting the new phenomena of physics into a coherent conceptual framework. But the way he talks does, I think, splendidly highlight the way in which the craft of theoretical physics is carried on and the frame of mind in which these people approach their work. To begin with, I asked him about his first major excursion into physics, which began in the years immediately before the Second World War, when he was a student, first at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and then a graduate student at Princeton. What was Feynman doing then?
I'd been working on a problem about the interaction of light and matter, which is called electrodynamics. And the problem of the day was that they had developed a quantum theory for matter, and they had developed a quantum theory for electrodynamics and matter together. But the quantum theory of the electrodynamics part, the electricity and magnetism part, and the light part, had troubles. If you made the calculation roughly, which, by the way, was quite accurate, but if you tried to make a more refined calculation, it gave absurd results, infinities, and so forth. So the theory was somehow right, but clearly mathematically absurd. And the question was, what exactly is it? And what if we ever did measure something accurately enough that we needed better than the first approximation, we needed the higher approximation where you get infinity, what would the correct way to calculate a sensible answer be? And so that was the problem I worked on.
Was this problem really analogous in some ways to the problem that Lorentz had stumbled on in the 19th century? In other words, when you make an accurate calculation of the classical energy of an electron sitting in its own electrostatic field, you come out with the answer infinity for the self-mass if the radius of the electron is zero.
Precisely, as a matter of fact, with one difference. In the classical theory, there was no reason to say that the electron's radius need be zero. It might have been, it was a little ball of charge, and the answer was not infinity because it wasn't the point. But when the quantum theory of electron came out, Dirac's theory of the electron, there was no room to modify it. There was no analog in the quantum theory of a non-point-like electron. The analog of the Dirac electron was a point-like electron, and the analogy was too good. It also gave infinite energy of the interaction of the electron with its own field. And that was the problem, yes, exactly so.
The idea of an electron with a finite radius was unacceptable.
No, it was undescribable.
So what did you do about this problem in those years before the war?
Before I got to Princeton, when I was at MIT, and I was rather naive and simple-minded, I thought of a very simple idea. I thought, how absurd to say that an electron interacts with itself. That electric force between two things was a direct force from one electron to another. It was described in those days by saying the electron made a field, a disturbance, and then in that disturbance, the electric field, the other electron reacted. I would have it, no, this one electron interacts with another directly. It seemed to me that was simple. And therefore, I can just make a rule, it doesn't act on itself. Whereas they couldn't make such a rule, because if the electron made a field which acts on any electron, it also, that field acts on the very electron that made it, you see. You can't distinguish the different fields by who made them. There was supposed to be one field that all the electrons contributed to making, and that field acted back on all the electrons, which had as an effect electron acting on itself. So it seemed to me all the problems were solved if I just said, no, it's not indirect. The electron acts directly on another electron.
Were you, in a sense, trying to disinter the old idea of action at a distance?
Yes, indeed. There was a serious problem, of course.
What
was
that?
Light. Yeah. You see, when to turn on a light, we knew it took time for the action to occur on the eye very far away. Light goes at a certain speed. And so that the view was that the light made this disturbance in the field and that traveled along, and so you needed the field. But I said, no, you don't need the field, it's just this. There's action at a distance. When you shake an electron, its motion, when you change its motion, it affects another electron at a distance, but with a delay. When you move this, it pushes on the other one later. Never mind that there's something going in between. The idea that there's something going in between is to add a whole lot of extra variables and complications, and that all the trouble was coming from there.
So this was what you were playing with.
That's
in the
right.
Years before the war, when you were an undergraduate and graduate student. And
yes.
So on. What happened after the war?
Well, I continued trying to do this. Immediately after the war, I had difficulties. I had psychological difficulties. I considered I'd been burned out. I couldn't get any ideas and so on. But aside from all those things, after about a year or two, there had been some measurements made on a hydrogen atom, very, very accurate measurements of the position of two levels, which were by Lamb. It's called the Lamb shift. In order to calculate that difference, we had to use the highest refinements of the quantum electrodynamic theory, where you get all these infinities and troubles and absurdities. Yet there was a nice experimental number of thousands, some odd megacycles, and the problem was, how do you get that? So Hans Bethe tried to take this theory and mutilate it effectively, just say, well, this gives infinity for this reason, and this gives an infinity here, and I got to subtract them because I want the difference in these two levels, and so on, so on. So it sounds absurd, but by subtracting two infinite numbers, he was able to get a finite number and had it come out about the right number, but he had to make a few guesses. And in giving a talk about this, he said, if I had any theory at all that was analogous to electrodynamics, but in which the self-energy that you were describing came out finite instead of infinite, I don't care, very large, then I'd have no trouble if, when I subtract the two very big numbers to find the residual, because there's no difficulty in subtracting big numbers to find the residual.
It's only if they're
infinite.
It's just
infinite. You can't tell what's left. All right. So I said, oh, I could do that. I said, I came down after the lecture. Because, you see, during the period in between, I'd been worrying about these problems of electrodynamics all this time, and I had invented methods for solving electrodynamic problems.
Still in the context of your action at a distance.
Yes. In fact, all the techniques were built in order to describe interaction of electrons without the intermediary field, you see, indirectly, because of that purpose. And so I had all this machinery and all this ability, which I didn't realize. But I knew how to modify electrodynamics. I had turned electrodynamics upside down, in and out, and so forth, all modifications. I knew how to modify it to make things finite. And I said, here's how you do it. He says, tell me tomorrow. You come in tomorrow with it. I said, all right, I'll do it tomorrow. We came in, and the funny thing was that I never even had done the simple problem in the conventional electrodynamics. In other words, with the conventional bad infinite problems, I never turned my machinery to see what happened.
You mean conventional classical
electrodynamics? No, quantum mechanics.
Yes.
In the without including the field and doing everything the standard way rather than my classy way with the field eliminated. I was only with my classy way. So he had to tell me just how to go about the calculation, and we did it together on the blackboard. And instead of it coming out finite, it came out, if it's going to describe it this way, as more infinite than before. It's hard to explain what it could be, what it could...
It diverged more quickly.
Yes, the answer got to infinity faster and easier than it did before. And I was rather surprised, confused, because I thought it would be otherwise. So I went back and I worried about it. And I went through the logic of my argument that it should be finite again and again, very carefully, and convinced myself that I had to come out finite. And then there was only one recourse left. I had to find out how to make these calculations right by the conventional way, in spite of the fact that I knew so much, I'd never done any real problem. It's very peculiar. So I read in the books how to do it, and I turned all this machinery which I had, this powerful machinery, the gun, so to speak, instead of being aimed at getting rid of the field, were aimed at doing the regular calculation. And they turned out to be very, very powerful, and it was very easy for me to do the calculation. And it came out finite. And to this day, we don't know what mistake we made on the blackboard. It was obviously some trivial mistake, because I didn't change anything but just did it over again a month or two later, and everything was all right, as I thought it had to be. So it was just some dumb mistake.
And that's the work that actually got you a Nobel Prize?
Yes, the...
In 1948.
Because after we make a system for making finite, then you could make the subtractions following Mr. Bethe's ideas and get a precise number without any ambiguity, you see, and then make all the corrections which were making things finite go to infinity, just make them disappear, and you get sensible answers to physical problems. So we now had, in 1948, a theory to describe the interaction of electrons and light and electric and magnetic fields that was, at that time, as accurate as we knew how to measure.
And in fact, of course, everything that's happened since has confirmed that that's a good picture.
Quantum electrodynamics works. I don't know why you say of course, though. But why of course? It's just a miracle. It turns out that that theory, which was made 20 years ago, not by my alone, because at the same time Professor Schwinger was doing a similar, different methods, coming to the same conclusion. We now have this theory made in 1948 for that particular part of our understanding of nature, which has turned out to be accurate as far as we've been able to measure even today. And it's very much more deeply measured today than before. We measure electromechanical interactions. I've been verified that the laws are right to distances, which is 1/10 the size of a proton, which is a very tiny, and this highest energy that we've been able to make in the machines, the phenomena still agree insofar as they only involve electrons and photons of light exactly with the theory.
It's a bit like Schrödinger, isn't it, who, by legend anyway, set out to construct a modification of classical mechanics that would make quantum mechanics unnecessary, and of course in the process developed a wave equation and things like that. Whether the legend is true, of course, it's hard to tell.
Well, let's suppose the legend is true. It's analogous in one respect, the one that you mentioned, but I would like to say it's not analogous in another, in that the thing that he discovered was really new laws, a real understanding of something new, whereas the thing that I discovered was this. The principle of how to do it was laid out in 1928 when they wrote these equations.
Dirac,
how to compute with them. Yeah, the quantum electrodynamics. The Dirac and Pauli and Heisenberg worked this stuff out. Quantum electrodynamics. But they got into trouble when they carried it out. It got confusing how to handle the infinities. And all we've done in 1948 was invent a kind of shell game to sweep the infinities under the rug in a kind of organized way. It's hard to explain any other detail.
Yeah.
So that we knew how to compute from that theory correctly, and they might have invented it at 1928. It wasn't really much more than a technical trick. I had contributed also an efficiency of calculations, for which I've gotten even more recognition than the thing. It's from the efficiency of the methods of calculating that people appreciate, but that's just a matter of, you know, of inventing tricks, mathematical tricks. And so it's not analogous to Schrödinger, who was not inventing mathematical tricks, but a new equation for a new phenomenon. And that I didn't do in 1948. And of course, I always wanted to.
One of the things that came out of that period was this tremendously vivid way of describing the interaction between particles, or the way in which interactions between particles are mediated by photons, if they're electrically charged or whatever, by means of graphs. Now,
pictures.
Feynman diagrams.
Little pictures, diagrams. Yeah.
And you see these things that have an electron and a photon going in, and an electron and a photon coming out.
Yes, we knew
something
we,
being exchanged in between. And
we bought a new camping van that we drive around. We like to camp out in the desert and so on. And it's decorated all around with these diagrams. I had a problem when I was trying to make my quantum theory of the direct interaction at a distance. There had been, quantum theory had been developed previously, and the method of going from classical theory to quantum theory was well established. But in order to go from classical theory to quantum theory, and I had a classical theory first of action at a distance, and I wanted to make a quantum theory. But in order to go, the classical equations had to be in a certain form, which we call a differential equations, which said something like this. If you tell me what it's like now, the equation tell you what it's like the next moment, okay? And the next moment. Now, the way that the electromagnetic field was ordinarily described was this. Tell me where the electrons are and what's going on in the field, and I'll tell you where the electrons will be in the next moment. They're coasting, you see. And how the field will wiggle just a little bit for the next moment. Those are called differential equations. But I had no field. And what my electron was going to do in the next moment didn't depend on what this electron is doing now, but what it did. All right? So I couldn't describe the equation by saying, tell me where everything is now, and I'll tell you what happened the next moment, because I had no field. So where everything was now wasn't enough to know what's going to happen, because it required knowing where the thing had been because of the action to turn down a delay, you see. And so it would needed a new form to transform from classical to quantum theory. And so I had to find another way to go from classical physics to quantum mechanics, which was quite different than the standard ways of Heisenberg and Schrödinger. And I found such a way, which was mathematically equivalent to their ways, but would apply to a situation in which there was delays, which didn't have to have differential equations. And it was such a difference in the way. It's only mathematical difference because it's mathematically equivalent, but it's psychologically very different. So it left you a way of thinking which was different than the ordinary way and suggested a more efficient way of analyzing the actual interactions and it ended up with these diagrams.
Feynman's described his work in 1948 as a kind of technical innovation, but that's over-modest. What he and Julian Schwinger of Harvard University did, independently, was to make it possible to solve problems in electrodynamics which had previously been insoluble, at least in a way that carried intellectual conviction. Feynman's way of dealing with these problems entailed inventing what was essentially a new language, and as he said, it so far stood the test of time. Several things struck me about his account of this early work, for which he won a Nobel Prize. First, he spent 10 years working away on the development of mathematical techniques for solving the problems of electrodynamics in what was then, as it is now, an eccentric direction. Second, he did this in an iconoclastic fashion, not bothering much to ask whether other people would consider his effort well spent. Then, finally, he had the wit and the willingness to see that his guns, as he called them, could be turned in a quite different direction once there was a tangible target on which to train them. What came next in Feynman's work was an assault on the problem of the weak interactions of nuclear physics. These are the forces that hold particles such as electrons and protons so tightly together that they make not a hydrogen atom, but a neutron. In the 1950s, the problem was how best to find a theoretical framework in which to describe them. As it turned out, Feynman's solution wasn't complete, although it seemed so at the time, and although it's the basis on which more sophisticated theories of the weak interaction have since been built. How did Feynman embark on that development?
You remember I told you that I was interested one day, for instance, I might discover a law. You see, I like Dirac, one day he came along and began to think, what's the right equation for an electron? And he found an equation to describe the behavior of an electron, which nobody knew before. And with the question, was nature going to obey it? And sure enough, it turned out when they looked at it, there it was. So he knew for a while something which nobody else knew. I never was in that position. I made a more efficient way to compute something. I didn't know anything that nobody else knew. Somebody else could do it. It would just take them longer, you see. Yeah, but I discovered, I was worked later in 1957 or so on what we call the weak interaction, the beta decay formulas, and for a short period, I guessed the right equation and knew the laws. It's not as big as a Dirac equation, it's just a smaller corner, but it has the same thrill of understanding nature, how she should work by guessing. The most remarkable thing. People measure things all around and give clues as to how nature's working, and you catch on to a formula. How can it be possible for mankind, man, to know how it's going to behave in experiments which have never been done before, which are quite different in many ways, by some kind of thinking about the pattern? That is really a thrill. That's the fundamental thrill of theoretical physics. So I had the pleasure of, in a somewhat...
Of seeing that come out.
That happened too to me, that I had a pleasure for a short, well, for a while.
Why do you say for a while?
Because pretty soon experimenters measure these things and other people understand. Everybody knows as much as I do about it, right?
That's right.
It's true. I knew it before, but after a while they all measure and everybody agrees the formula was right that I guessed and so forth. So that's what I meant by for a while. I knew for a while something nobody else knew.
Yeah.
Okay? Now I guessed for a while a truth which had not been seen by others.
Now it's a part of what everyone knows, but it still stands.
And we now know with most recent measurements, it's fairly incomplete, and that there's much more to it, and that I had only turned up a little corner of it, and the question is, what does the rest of it look like? And we're all trying to guess it, eh?
You're talking about the weak interaction.
Yes.
And in the past 2 years, perhaps, right. The weak interaction and the neutral current in particular
have been
demonstrated and so on. You hadn't anticipated
no.
The neutral current.
No, sir.
But in practice, isn't this what it's always like? Even poor Newton, if he'd lived long enough, would have found that he hadn't got it quite right.
Not Newton. Well, lived long enough, of course.
That's right. I mean, lived till 1900.
I know, but he didn't live long enough. I lived long enough to see it's not right.
Yeah,
that's not the same. Okay. But I don't mind that it's not right. It gives a new problem. But I'm not complaining. I mean, after all, I don't compare myself to Newton. You know what happens when you're a student. You ask your students that are coming in, you know, they're going into theoretical physics, and you say, what would you feel like? What are you trying to be like? Bolston? And they say, who's Bolston? You know, he's just an ordinary Joe that just did a little something, right? Then they say, no, I'm thinking of. And then they'll name it. If you can name it on one hand, they're lucky. They think of Einstein. They think of Newton. They want to be like Dirac. All right? Well, there aren't going to be very many of the students that are going to come out like that, okay? Now, when I was young, I thought that way. You know, that...
You've not done badly.
I haven't done badly at all, is what I'm trying to say. But you know, what's wrong with I thought of it for a little while? Something that nobody else knew. So now they've caught up and we have a new problem. I have the fun of working on the new problem.
And
it's not any disappointment that it only lasted a little while. It was lucky that in my life I had a moment of this pleasure because I had dreamt of having it when I was young.
That's the excitement of discovery, and Feynman's enjoyed a lot of it. 10 years ago, for example, he set out to account theoretically for the results of some then puzzling experiments, which appeared to show that apparently fundamental particles such as protons have an internal structure, contrary to what people then expected. The result was a theory that described protons and neutrons in terms of certain hypothetical particles called partons. And as it's now turned out, Feynman was in the process following an independent route to the conclusion that nuclear particles like these are constructed from other particles called quarks, which for the time being at least are supposed to be the entities of which all particles of matter are constructed. So is the present time more exciting and potentially more fruitful than the heady days a quarter of a century ago, when the physicists had discovered these strange particles but hadn't called them strange, and when they'd recognized the difference between pi mesons and mu mesons, but didn't know what the mu meson was for? Richard Feynman.
It seemed to me at that time that that was too early for a theoretical physicist to really make any deep contributions. You can make small contributions. You could suggest that this phenomenon indicates that. In other words, partial unravelings, but no deep synthesis of anything, because there wasn't enough to synthesize. There weren't enough clues. It was clear, terrible. It was like the bottom of a great ice, you know, mystery. Big mystery, you see a corner. You know you're only seeing a corner. It's no use trying to guess what the shape of this enormous monster is. You've only seen too small an amount. So I guessed that I didn't have enough to work on. And so I worked on other problems.
You implied just now that there were now more clues, perhaps even enough clues, for going back to this fundamental attack.
Oh, now, yes, definitely. I think that we've got too many clues. That's what I like. When there are so many clues, that if you happen to hit a little bit of the right combination, many things will be explained that were mysterious before. You see, that have already been measured, that we know about, that fit. And so you can tell when you're going in the right direction, because if you guess something, more will come out than you put in. You understand? You look at the phenomena, and that gives you a clue. You look at everything you can look at, everything that's known. Many things are puzzling, you put them aside for a while. It's like doing a jigsaw, so you put them aside. There's that funny piece with pink on it that doesn't, you know. And then there's another piece here, and then you put that piece in, and all of a sudden you see where the pink one goes. You didn't expect to see that. That makes more sure that you put the right piece in, you see. And it gives you a yield. More came out than you put in. You looked at a certain shape, you said, this looks like that piece goes here. And lo, when you put it in there, you can put another piece in. Well, now we're in a position that we have enough facts in a certain range of physics having to do with a high energy particle, and a kind of a theory about quarks and so on, that when you hit the right exact combination of quantitative view, it'll yield. You'll know right away that you've got it right. It's the right time to work on it.
When I talked to him, Richard Feynman wasn't too willing to say which of the clues, of which he now says there are too many, are likely to be the most significant. That's consistent with what he says about being willing to travel along this road without knowing where he's going to arrive. But what's he doing to try and construct a framework for understanding the new phenomena, the new psi particles, for example? What's he working on now?
It's somewhat the same problem associated with these partons and so on that I did in 1968. All the things that have been evolved in the high energy physics are some kind of approximations to the right equation. And people keep talking about different methods of approximation to it. They say the two-particle approximation, they describe the thing and they write some equations, or the bootstrap approximation, or they have different technical names. But they never tell us what it's an approximation to. To the final theory or to some form, it's very hard to explain. It's sort of qualitative. They talk as though they're talking about equations, but it ends up being a qualitative description. But the words sound like they're talking about a mathematical theory that they have an approximation to. They don't tell us what it's approximating. It's as though you say, you're going to approximate a house by saying it's a kind of a block, shape of a block. They say, what's the next approximation? Well, it's not exactly a block, it's just kind of windows in it, you see. If you were to take some of these people and say, start with the first approximation that it's like this. You say, well, what in principle vaguely could a next approximation even look like? You know, what are you talking about? What are you approximating?
And you say they can't say that now.
They have no way to describe. I don't mean they haven't the right way to describe it, but they don't even know what it is that this is an approximation to. So what I want is a structural form that I can carry and say, this equation tells us this feature about it, this equation tells us that feature about it, and so on, even though I don't have the full answer. I know the experiments are telling me about.
But if I understand you rightly, you're talking about high-energy physics. So how does one go about describing the general form that these equations should have without solving, as it were, the whole problem?
Well, suppose you say that the phenomena comes from a thing analogous to electrodynamics, something like the electrodynamic theory, but with different kinds of terms in it, something we call field theory. Let's say it comes from a field theory. And then you say, very well, it comes from a field theory. What kind of a field theory? Now you have to find out what fundamental fields are in there, and that's where the quark theory has yielded. That tells us that the fundamental fields, if there are fields at all, might be quarks. If so, then you would expect to say, then I'll describe this in the standard field theory, but there isn't any form for it. You could say, there is an approximate, if the coupling is weak,
any one of these approximations is an approximation to something undefined.
That's right. One way would be to say you give a amplitude, I'll call it probability, it's close enough, the probability of finding, say, three quarks inside the proton in certain places. And say that would be the element that would have a certain probability of being in different places. And from that, I can figure out what the magnetic properties are and what the... No, you can't do it that way, because there is sometimes a new pair of quarks is produced. You say, oh, well, that's just an approximation. I have a probability of finding three quarks and a probability of finding five quarks and so forth, and the probability of finding five and so on is very small. I leave that term out. That's good. But the thing I'm approximating is something which has three, five, seven, and so on quarks. Good? Fine. Now, you go on and say, but that isn't going to be enough, because the quarks have forces between. I want to describe those forces. They can't be instantaneous. It takes some delay, so instead of that, I have to have the particle.
The speed of light.
Yes, so I have to have the, just like I was describing earlier with electrodynamics, we have to have something to represent the transfer of the force. So you'd have to tell not only the probability of finding the three quarks, but also the probability of finding the interaction, so to speak, or the field of interaction, some state. And you need to know what kind of variables to describe that in, and how many intermediary gluons or whatever it is there. So you have to write an equation, which is the amplitude for finding three quarks, five quarks, seven quarks, the amplitude with no field in between, with a field, one unit of field, one quantum of field, two quanta going here, going there. Big mess. I don't care how big the mess. I just want it to be that you write a plan out, and then you say, now these equations are the full set that I'm approximating, and these properties, like you, when you measure the magnetic moment, you're measuring this property of that mess of numbers, those probabilities, and when you're measuring this property of experiment, you're measuring this other property of this mess of numbers, and so on.
Is it your hunch that when this is done, the general framework of Heinze physics will be described for the first time?
No, it would only be like this gas business, that you'd then have to find the right laws of interaction. I mean, you've got the framework and you know what numbers go into pigeonhole, but you know the law for it. You haven't guessed that. Now, there's another way. You don't have to have solved my problem in order to solve the problem of high energy physics, because somebody could come along and guess the whole thing and to say, this is the mathematical structure in which everything works and this is the right answer. And from it, we calculate this way for this experiment and that way for that experiment, and so on. I'm trying to meet it halfway. You could guess the right equation from the beginning. I haven't been able to guess the right equation from the beginning, nor other people. So what do? You stop thinking? No, in the meantime, maybe I can work my way partway to find out about the guess. In the meantime, some young fella may guess the answer and undercut the whole works, you see.
The answer's obviously going to be mathematical.
Yes.
Why is it that the laws of physics always turn out to be mathematical and relatively simple?
Well, Dirac explained it by saying that God was a mathematician.
Yes, but leaving that aside.
I can't.
But it's a fact, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it's a fact. What I meant by I can't is that I have no answer to this question whatsoever. It is one of the things that has puzzled me very often, a philosophical question. I just don't really understand why it is that mathematical type of reasoning and description ends up as being necessary. It was discovered by Newton, for example, when he made his law of gravity, that the force between the planets is inversely as the square of the distance, and that they accelerate proportional in a direction proportional to the force and divided by the mass, and so on. Those are mathematical descriptions. What happens is the planet look at the sun, scratch its head and say, I'm so and so far away, I must divide by the distance squared on my little computer, and that tells me how fast it will accelerate. There's no mechanism. It's only a mathematical description of the relationship. And when Newton was asked, you know, he had that famous statement that he makes no hypotheses, and what he meant was that he felt that he was making some success in at least describing what was happening, and he was pointing out that you could go a long way without making any machine underneath. And from that time on, people have tried to make machines underneath. In the days of electrodynamics, Maxwell tried to put a machinery of idler wheels and everything, which made it very difficult for people to accept his electrodynamic equations, even though they were completely right, because they didn't like his idler wheels, and they couldn't find another machine underneath it. But we've gradually become, shall we say, more sophisticated, or perhaps given up, where we say the mathematical description is all we've got. But what is very strange, has been consistently true, is that whenever we found out our deepest understanding, that is deepest in the sense that it agrees best with experiment, the ultimate description is utterly abstractly mathematical. It is never mechanistic. It's less and less mechanistic. There's never been a solution to this problem of Newton's, of how does the planet figure out where it is. Well, there have been other mathematical descriptions. It figures it out by finding the rate of change of the potential. That's another matter. Yeah. But it ends up mathematical. So I'm quite convinced that the ultimate description of these things will be in mathematical language. The best way to say it is just exactly paraphrasing what Mr. Dirac said, but in an unreligious way, is that the correct language to describe nature is mathematics.
This argument about the relationship between physics and mathematics is, of course, as old as the hills, and may in any case not be a real argument. Perhaps it's just a question of inventing new mathematical language to describe all new phenomena in physics. But the belief that when you've found the right language, the laws of physics turn out to be mathematically simple and even elegant, that does have intellectual content. It's, of course, the old Pythagorean view, but it's also a guiding principle in theoretical physics, even though the practitioners may not be prepared to admit it. In any case, of course, when you're concerned not so much to say what the laws of physics are, but to understand the complicated phenomena that are observed in the real world,
the behavior of stars, for example, things aren't by any means simple. So I asked Feynman to say how much weight he gave to the now common view that there's an ever stronger link between physics and cosmology, and that in particular, the cosmologists may soon contribute in important ways to the continuing refinement of the laws of physics.
Unfortunately, I don't think they'll be successful. The reason is the phenomena, it's the same game again that I talked about the game of drafts. You know the rules, but in a real situation, the thing is very complicated. And the stars are real situation. They're very complicated. Swirls, like the sun. It's got sunspots and swirls and storms and fluctuating, all kinds of stuff. Very hard to understand, even though you understand the laws. It's just like the waves of the ocean are hard to understand, even though you know all the laws of water flow. So in the stars, even though we might know the laws, we can't really figure out what'll happen very well. So it's very hard to see something in the sky which is happening and to say this is impossible according to the standard laws, and therefore we know there must be another law of physics. It's very hard. It's not likely that they'll be so sure of themselves that they'll be able to say this can't happen according to ordinary laws. For example, we now have quasars, which are tremendous developments of energy in a very small space very quickly. Nobody knows how they work. That is, according to the normal laws of physics, ordinary matter coming together, exactly what's happening there so as to liberate all that energy. But nobody is sure enough of what can happen. Maybe there could be a whirlpool of magnetic force that builds up and explodes. We don't know enough to be sure that ordinary matter, following the laws so far understood, can't produce that, although it's very hard to figure out how. So we don't know in that example whether that's an example which shows that the laws of physics are not complete, that the development of energy requires another physical phenomenon that we have. Just, it's a clue that there's something else going on, that it's going to take us 50 years to discover in the lab, or whether it's just, we know all the fundamental things, it's just that we don't know what the situation is up there.
There's one other issue that's come up in cosmology recently that I'd like to put to you. The idea is this, contrary to what people say, that we should regard the universe from the point at which we see it as really unexceptional. It would look the same wherever else we were. It would look, in general terms, the same at whatever other time we happen to be looking at the universe. People now say it may not be quite like that, because it's taken us 10 to the 9th years, a billion years or thereabouts, to evolve life on the Earth. Therefore, the universe we see is already pre-selected, as it were. This they call the anthropic principle. Does that offend you?
What?
That line of argument.
No, it's true that we've been on the Earth 10 to the 9th years, and so the universe we've looked at is that old.
A fact. And that's
That's just a fact. You said a few things. I'd like to kind of... First of all, the idea that the universe must be the same everywhere as where we are has always struck me rather oddly. It's like this. You are dropped at random. It was not supposed to be any special place, because it's a counteraction against the idea that we were special, God made us, okay?
Yeah,
so we become modest, all right?
All right?
So you go and you drop it at random in a forest. At random in a forest, anywhere. You look around, you happen to see there are birch trees around you, right? So you conclude the forest is utterly made of birch trees, because if it isn't that there's birch trees everywhere, we'd be in a special place. But we're not in a special... It's true, there are lumps of birch trees, lumps of maple trees, lumps of... We happen to land it there. It's not necessary that where we are is like where everything is in order that we be, so to speak, any old place, okay? We're two-thirds the way out from the center of the galaxy and so on. And that's the sense that we don't have to have everything uniform. So I never understood that. It is true, however, experimentally, that if we look very far away at the galaxies, they do seem to be distributed more or less the same number per square superparsec, however it is, in every direction.
And this astonishingly uniform speed of recession in all directions, isotropic.
Yes, right. It does look the same in all directions if you go far enough away. By the way, it does not look that way at all if you go relatively short distance.
But that's the birch trees.
Maybe. But that means that the forests are uniform beyond a certain size, which it didn't have to be. So therefore, I don't know about that principle. But this other principle, it depends on what you conclude from this business about 10 to the 9th. I heard people say things like, you know, life has to take 10 to the 9th years to evolve and so on. Stuff like that. Now, I know enough about science to know that we don't know anything much about science, right? and that phenomena like life, or especially its beginnings and its evolution rate, is not understood in any general sense. We know what happened. We know it took 10 to the 9th years on the Earth. There's an awful lot of baloney these days. Baloney is an English expression for, American expression, I mean, for, I don't know what you have, for applesauce or something. False wisdom that says things like, the conditions of life, a planet has to have in order to have life on it. Meaning by life, a reproducing chemical phenomenon, all right? Or intelligence, a certain kind of animal. There was even times when people said to get an intelligent animal, you had to evolve a thumb which opposed the fingers. It's just not known what is needed to evolve life, what it needs to go to start, what chemically is required. We know what kind of life we've got. Yes, we need carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, so we need oxidizing atmosphere and so on. If you didn't know better, you wouldn't believe that life could live underwater. It's an example, right? But you know. Or you wouldn't think that the living forms could be stationary with roots in the ground. But they came first, and they're more important than these dopey parasites which eat them. And so on. The situation is far too complex for our real understanding to be able to say what life has got to be like, what the chemical conditions have got to be in order to have life, that is to say a reproducing thing, or to have intelligence. We don't know how much time or what conditions it needs. It might go 10 to the 4th or 10 to the 6th, a million times faster than we see it going now, evolution and so on. So I don't believe any of these things, which takes a subject that we understand as little as the complex chemistry of biology and uses a fact about it as if it's a rigid necessity of the conditions, a law of physics, that it takes 10 to the 9th years to evolve a brain.
There again, you heard Feynman's agnostic view. So how is all this to be conveyed to students? Feynman has an international reputation as an educator, chiefly because of his startling physics textbook, Lectures in Physics, published 15 years ago. He says he's not much good with graduate students, chiefly because of his solitary ways. But how does he set out to teach people not just about the known techniques of physics, but about the way in which they should decide for themselves what problems are worth tackling?
There are two aspects of a subject, which, of course, there are lines in between and they shouldn't be separated, but roughly speaking, there's the techniques of actually doing something, and there's the kind of the spirit of it. There are, how do you choose problems, and why is it generally interesting, and what is it all about kind of bit. I learned this because I went to drawing classes. And the art teachers have a problem. They have these two aspects. Now, the trouble with drawing is that the technique takes less than 15 minutes to explain. The techniques consist of, they tell you that the pencils have different hardnesses, and by reading, B is soft and S is hard, and so on, and that you can get a good kind of paper here. A newsprint is a cheap form to draw on, and so on. Then they're finished.
The technique's over in 15 minutes.
Yeah, that aspect. The next thing is to tell you how to go about it, you know, what to think about in the drawing, why you're drawing at all. What is the idea of it? To get this, they don't use the word, but the aspect of aesthetics or the whole aim of the subject. And they don't know what to do. They sort of stand behind you and mumble. Because no matter what you do, they can always say, they don't know how you would evolve if you really carried that on further. And so they're kind of frightened. Now, they have a very difficult teaching job. Now, in physics, that would also be difficult. We shouldn't tell a student the thing to do is to think by analogy. Because there's maybe another way, by thinking by mathematical equation. Think only of the equations. No, because maybe if you think of the mechanism behind you, or if you try, you might get better. Or think of the historical development and make an analog. Maybe yes, maybe no. All those techniques is very difficult and frightening to teach. Not techniques, the non-technique. But unlike the arts, the techniques, how to do integrals, how to do the mathematics, learn different mathematical things and so on, is so much that we can spend all our time telling him about the techniques, and practically no time on the part that's hard to teach. And what it all comes down to is that's exactly what we do in teaching science.
We teach techniques.
Most of us, and I include myself, end up by spending an awful lot of time without any inspiring lectures about the wonders of it.
Professor Richard Feynman on the craft of theoretical physics. Good night.